I guess one of the reasons that you came today is either you know me and just kind of doing, a friend one good one, or you think I'm gonna tell you something and then you're gonna learn something new from me. That might be the case, right? That might be one of the reasons you can come to like the moral sciences club. That's kind of weird, right? Like if I ask you after you leave, it's like, so what is, did you gain a new belief from me? Like, do you know now? Do you know something in particular, right? That would be quite odd, right? I mean, my purpose here is not to tell you something, right? And you coming here, you don't expect me. You don't have that kind of expectation. Instead, I think what we're really doing, what we're really doing here, is very simply we're trying to think together. And that doesn't seem to kind of reduce or to be exhausted by kind of testimony or me just telling you something, right? And you learning something new. Something deeper here is going on. And that's going to be the task for us today, to flesh out this notion. Now, I want to start the story a little bit earlier than what we're doing here at the Moral Sciences Club. So in my mind, the story starts on an island in the 12th century. So there's a very famous Islamic philosopher that is called Ibn Tufayl, who lived in Andalus, kind of southern Spain, in the medieval sort of 12th century. And he wrote a very influential sort of novelette, very small novelette, about a man who was born on an island to dear parents, right? There's no humans other than him on the island. And progressively, this man called Hayy ibn Yaghzan, alive, son of awake, kind of progressively starts to know things, right? He sort of perceives the environments around him. He deduces from him that, he's separate from that environment. He goes on to kind of deduce other things about, what is out there in the world, et cetera, et cetera. He builds up slowly, slowly from these simple perceptions to a view about the sort of the existence of God. God must exist, he claims. And he figures that out all by himself. So the story goes, right? I mean, the purpose of that novelette is that reasoning by your own is compatible with revelation, but that's not sort of the point. But the point is, a live son of awake figures everything out by himself. This sentiment will later obviously catch on in sort of in the so-called Enlightenment, and it's kind of a very, very familiar notion, right? To think for yourself. And here's Locke on it. I find this quote very nice. Captures the sentiment quite well. He says, "For I think we may as rationally hope to see with other men's eyes, as to know by other men's understandings, so much so as we ourselves consider and comprehend of truth and reason, so much we possess of real and true knowledge. The floating of other men's opinions in our brains makes us not a jot more knowing, though they happen to be true." Moving forward, sort of in the narrative, we have, sort of a realization among epistemologists in particular that, this picture is just an idea, right? But in reality, we need to defer to other people. We depend on other people for knowledge, right? So, philosophers, epistemologists started to think about the nature of epistemic dependence, right? Think about sort of big science, right? You need to depend on other people for your knowledge. Most of the work there has concentrated on deference, right? Where I defer, you have kind of an epistemic authority about some subject matter, you're an expert, and then I go to you and ask you, and then you tell me that something is the case, right? I don't have access, you have the access, right? So most of the ink sort of has been spilled on the nature of testimony within that. But I think between this kind of ideal of epistemic autonomy, kind of, captured by a live son of awake, our kind of hero, and kind of the need for deference that we see in kind of organized kind of knowledge practices, something goes missing. And that, I think, is kind of the domain of thinking together, which is the exact thing that we come and do here every week at the Moral Sciences Club. So basically, what I want to sort of tell you today is there is an epistemically interesting phenomenon going on here, right? That doesn't seem to reduce to that kind of sort of deference, testimonial exchanges that we might think of. thinking together has kind of seeming features that, you know, carries a different profile. But also, I will suggest a little bit, it carries a different moral profile at the end. Common examples are like casual conversation as well, not necessarily the kind of organized conversation like the moral sciences. Joint exploration of like topics, whatever we're doing, like we're talking about philosophy like afterwards in the pub or at dinner, just jointly exploring an idea, for instance. Advice, I think, kind of slightly falls onto thinking together. Certain modes of teaching as well, think about like supervision. The aim there is thinking together and not simply telling the student that something is the case. So here's sort of the plan, very briefly. I will try to motivate that we need an epistemology of thinking together, primarily through examples. I will suggest a broad model of what it means to think together. I will propose that it is a matter of what I will call perspectival alignment. And at the very end, I will suggest briefly that this picture complicates several sort of companion assumptions of standard epistemology. But we'll have to wait a little bit for that. Okay. So section one in your handout, what it looks like. So again, the paradigm example that I'm thinking about is this. What are we going to do in 45 minutes? So here's kind of one way the Q&A might begin, right? You might ask me whether thinking together is just a specific instance of group knowledge. I reply, well, not quite. You know, I'm thinking of sort of individual, you know, separate individuals, their own background beliefs and epistemic styles and response to the evidence. And we're coming together and trying to kind of share the same outlook with respect to whatever it is we're talking about. You give me an analogy, right? You like to think with analogies. So you give me an analogy and you say, well, think about rowing, right? This kind of weird activity. And then each of like, you know, you have eight people on the boat and each of them are individually doing movements, right? But then there's a sense that the boat as a whole is rowing, right? In a way that doesn't reduce to each individual rower rowing. Well, is that an instance of thinking together, this kind of collective aggregate phenomenon? I haven't thought about this analogy before, really, and I heard a little bit about group knowledge, but the way I'm thinking of it is slightly different. Right? There is a sense in which it's not just about me and you in the conversation. The moral science is just adding bits of knowledge and then or sharing a kind of intention that we become kind of a collective we of some sort. Not quite. But it's interesting that you suggested me this analogy, and I take it on and I keep thinking about it, right? It's a nice framing device. And it changes how I think over time. I started thinking more about the analogy. I started thinking about the individual level contributions to the conversation and if there's something above that's going on. And that frame kind of affects how I go on thinking about this project later on. But mindful of the time, you say, okay, let's continue with the dinner. Now, the question that I want to think about is, you and I, in this case, I think, leave epistemically altered by this kind of exchange. Quite intuitively, at the intuitive level, what we seem to be doing is we're trying to share a way of looking at things very broadly, but intuitively, I will argue. Now, so what's going on here? I think we can sort of try to contrast what's going on here with focusing on kind of neighboring examples, cases where you might think we're thinking together, but not quite. Here's an example. So suppose you don't know anything about football. For example, you don't know who won the 2002 World Cup. It was Germany against Brazil, you know. So you don't know who scored, for instance. And, you know, your friend who plays football every week and watches every game of the Premier League tells you, well, it's Ronaldo scored the two winning goals in the final against Germany. You didn't know this before. Your friend is, you know, decently reliable about these matters. So you trust him and, you know, you come to know this new fact that you would have otherwise not known, right? Is that a case of thinking together, this kind of exchange? Not quite. I want to say that when in the moral sense, when we're having this kind of conversation, what we're doing is not the kind of epistemic alteration we end up with. It's not simply a matter of like alteration in beliefs, right? We can talk and talk and our epistemic contribution doesn't result in you and I kind of changing our opinions. We can think together successfully without that happening. In some sense as well, thinking together sort of conversational nature and open-ended nature makes it, indicates at least, that it is not a case of testimony. Right? Why? Partially because the instance of thinking together doesn't turn on you and I kind of having the same belief, doesn't turn on opinional agreement, right? And that's partly because it kind of doesn't have a particular aim or endpoint, right? You stopped and tell, okay, let's continue with dinner, not because the activity epistemically stopped, there's a kind of epistemic stop point. No, it's just kind of just, it's always open-ended. We can always think together more in some sense without it ending. But in the case of a testimony exchange, when you know that Ronaldo scored the winning goals, that kind of ends the specific instance. So thinking together is not quite a case of testimony. Now, you might think that specific instances of teaching might qualify as kind of thinking together. So, for instance, imagine that you're doing kind of part three math, so I suppose you're good at math at that point. Still, you often rely on teacher in some respects, an important respect. For instance, one day you might, you know, your teacher might write a proof on the board and, you know, sort of guide you through the proof. But at the end of the day, although you kind of, you causally depend on the teacher and the way that they constructed the proof, you yourself nonetheless grasp the thing, right? Is that an instance of thinking together where, you know, teacher kind of sets up things and you go and grasp things? Not quite. I don't think that thinking together is, as it were, a fancy version of giving a proof, right? It's, there's something going on in terms of kind of the responsiveness required to be thinking together, right? It's not that I'm giving you an argument for it is to think together and then you come and, you know, you see what it is the case. Not quite. So that doesn't quite work. Now, here's kind of a very contrasting example that I quite like to think about, actually. So, you know, if you think about, you know, the famous proposal, Mr. Collins' proposal to Elizabeth in Pride and Prejudice, right? So I'll read out a little bit. You might think that this is a case of thinking together, but I will soon argue not quite. So here's Mr. Collins, right, to Elizabeth. He says, "Almost as soon as I entered the house, I singled you out as the companion of my future life. My reasons for marrying are, first, that I think it a right thing for every clergyman in either circumstances like myself to set the examples of matrimony in his parish. Secondly, that I'm convinced it will add greatly to my happiness. And thirdly, which perhaps I ought to have mentioned earlier, that it is a particular advice and recommendation of the very noble lady whom I have the honor of calling patroness." And then, you know, Elizabeth is like, "Yo, like, you're too hasty, man. Like, chill." And then, you know, there's an interesting back and forth there, right? And then what's interesting about the way that sort of conversation goes on is Mr. Collins says, doesn't take into account, he's not responsive at all into sort of what Elizabeth is saying. Although she's responding, she is giving kind of some reason of sort. But she says, no, I know that it is the custom of elegant ladies to refuse the first proposal, right? So in some sense, Mr. Collins is not responsive to Elizabeth's perspective at all. But neither is Elizabeth as well, right? Although Elizabeth kind of can, you know, imagine what Mr. Collins' kind of background is and can, you know, sympathize with what he's coming from, but she's not using his perspective as a kind of way to see, actually to see things. So I think that kind of as a feature to the practice of thinking together, it's not just about conversing open-endedly, it requires a kind of attunement to each other's perspectives, which is not necessarily required for the case of Ronaldo, for example, the case of simple deference. Now, to get a better handle of what's going on here, I think we need to do two things. First, I want us to kind of take a moment to expand the range of epistemic good when we're thinking about communicating together, when we're thinking together. I will particularly focus on communicating not knowledge, but understanding, and I will explain that in section two. And secondly, after that, I want us, given this picture of thinking that I will suggest, I want us to revise our notion of mental, of epistemic communication that underlies what is going on when we're thinking together. I will eventually suggest what I call sort of a perspectival model of epistemic communication. Okay, watch it back. Sorry. Okay, so what is it? Now, according to kind of standard picture epistemology, if you do kind of, one-on-one epistemology, you might think, that the kind of the central thing that we are kind of using to describe our epistemic lives, and the kind of central thing that we also kind of evaluate thinkers with respect to, is kind of propositional and doxastic attitudes like beliefs. Again, this has a both a descriptive dimension, namely, you can describe a range of phenomena just in terms of relation to these kind of attitudes. And it has a normative dimension, right? What it is to have like kind of true beliefs, what it is for a belief to be justified, et cetera, et cetera. Now, on our slightly expanded picture, our epistemic lives is just not limited to just belief formation. It involves what I will shortly describe as holistic understanding. And importantly, that does not reduce to beliefs or knowledge. So to sort of warm us up to the idea that I want to get to towards, consider this example of a gestalt. So who sort of sees the old lady? Oh, okay. Who sees the young lady? Does anyone not see anything? Okay, a few people does not. Okay, because you have to, because otherwise the example doesn't work. Okay. Need to help me out. So for those of you who see the old lady, I mean, I can try to point out the young lady by saying, well, look, here's like her nose, it's kind of eyelashes, her shin, her jawline, just kind of top of her hair. Right. So I can a little bit sort of point out to something. And then you might come to have that kind of shift, right? You might fail. But the idea is that you and I can be looking at the very same thing, but we can see different things. Here's another example to get us kind of closer to the notion. So this is a scene from a show that I really like called Rami. So Rami, the figure on the left, is kind of sort of in character in his late 20s, and he was brought up in a very traditional religious family. He was an immigrant family. And so he was brought up in a kind of culture very different from that of his parents, which embodies quite different values that are often in tension with his religious upbringing as the show goes on, right? He often struggles to adhere to kind of the external rules which he's supposed to be committed to. He doesn't, and he feels guilt and shame as a result of this kind of confusion sometimes. Eventually, he finds a nice teacher who's willing to help him out, Marshal Ali. And in a moment of confusion, it's a very nice scene where the teacher tells Rami, look, religion is like an orange. There's an outer and inner part. If someone only got the rules and rituals, they might think religion is tough and bitter, like the outside of an orange. But there's an inside, a juicy flesh, the divine intimacy, the spiritual experience. The rind without the flesh is bitter and useless. The flesh without the rind quickly rot. The outer protects the inner, and the inner gives the outer its purpose and meaning. Now, the purpose of this example in the show is that, kind of the purpose of this interaction in the show is that through this simple analogy, Rami, in some sense, advances his understanding of situation, right? As it is revealed in the show, it's kind of his confusion slightly dissolves by the help of this analogy. Why? Well, he comes to see the relations a little bit more clearly, something that he haven't sort of seen before. He comes to see the inner part of religion as kind of more explanatory fundamental, right? That's kind of the core of religion, right? See, he comes to see that as explanatory connected in different ways than he previously had seen. Here's another example that also kind of gets us close to what I want to say about this kind of holistic understanding. So, I mean, I lived through what's so-called, annoyingly called, Arab Spring. And my grandfather and I always talk about this. So this is the 2011. And my grandfather and I have, we know how the events unfolded. We know it's the event, right? But we think about it quite differently. We have very different perspectives on it. He thinks whenever we discuss, he thinks that the Muslim brother is the core, like sort of they ruined the thing, they started it, they ruined it, et cetera, et cetera. So he gives a lot of emphasis on kind of the religious sort of ground religious movements and political events. I, on the other hand, tend to sort of mostly focus on the kind of grassroots, more on lefty side political movements. And that for me, it plays a lot of kind of explanatory role whenever I'm thinking about revolution. So in some sense, although we can know certain things, my grandfather and I, the way that we assign kind of importance to different bits of information, what we see as salient, as is important, sort of explanatory salient when we're ever thinking, when we're thinking about, determines our total understanding of the event. What is understanding of that? I want to say that, you know, from these examples, we can think that understanding is not just a set of beliefs, but a sort of structure of salience, centrality, kind of organizational interpretive concepts of sorts that make information intelligible to us. So, for example, it involves dynamic frames, like analogies and metaphors, like the Rami case. It involves a kind of, as Jesse would put it, kind of a default accessibility ordering over a space of possible information. To put it simply, our perspective involves what is salient to us, not just a matter of what we know or believe. We might attend to things very differently. I might attend to the old lady's nose. You might attend to the young lady's jawline, prominent jawline. Although we're looking at the very, very same thing. We might ask different questions, right? My grandfather's inquiry might start because the Muslim Brotherhood is very prominent in his conception, in his perspective. He might start by asking questions about how did they come about, what did they do, etc. While I might be disposed to inquire differently. Now, importantly, this kind of underpins two things, right? As I've said, like it underpins what we see, what we recognize, right? The framing of the old lady might, you know, incline dispose you to see the old lady, right? And so on and so forth. But it's also because once we see something like that, once something is prominent, it influences the kind of inferences that we make, right? If what is more prominent in my sort of my holistic understanding of the Egyptian revolution is grassroots movements, then I'm inclined to give them more inferential and explanatory power whenever I'm thinking, whenever I'm inquiring about it. Good. So the key point here is that what matters for holistic understanding is not just what we believe or know, kind of the information that we possess statically, as it were, but how we sort of organize and structure information. And that, I want to say, is epistemically valuable, right? Although my grandfather and I might know kind of the same things, it matters, it might matter, relevant to some standard of relevance, for example, if the Muslim Brotherhood is the key notion or the key sort of feature of the event, or sort of grassroots, more liberal. Now, this is kind of the slight expansion that I want us to be thinking. So, what does this kind of broad picture of thinking tell us about thinking together? That's section three on your hand. Water break. So again, our question is, what does this picture of thinking, this kind of holistic understanding, more expanded picture, more inclusive picture, as it were, tell us about thinking together? Now, according to the standard picture that I've outlined a couple of minutes ago, you know, epistemic communication concerns the sharing of beliefs, right? It concerns whether we kind of converge on our opinions, as it were, right? In the case of Ronaldo, it matters. The end point of the game, as it were, the exchange, as it were, is that you and I come to believe the same thing, right? If I don't believe that Ronaldo scored, on the basis of you telling me, something has gone sort of wrong in that case. So we can easily see how this picture sort of lends itself to a doxastic or, you know, slightly propositional model of epistemic communication and by extension, thinking together. However, as we outlined in the beginning, I don't think this gets thinking together quite right. Something more is going on. But what is it? So I think it's helpful as a starting step to think about thinking together in terms of trust, in terms of the trust required for it to be, for an instance of epistemic communication to count as an instance of thinking together, whether good or bad. So on the one hand, the trust sort of involves in opinional or the sort of doxastic trust, an attitude towards sort of gaining true beliefs. Instead, I think the trust involved in thinking together is a kind of perspectival trust, to put it kind of broadly here. I think it trusts an interlocutor for holistic understanding when they are willing to accept their perspective and allow it to shape their inquisitive perspectives they implement, right? They allow them to shape what is salient to them, or the concept that they use, or the metaphors that they really uptake, and these metaphors in turn sort of shape what they recognize and the kind of inferences that are inclined to make. Trust is important. This particular kind of trust is important because it opens a different kind of epistemic access. As T. Nguyen sort of puts it nicely, I think, kind of a characteristic feature and function of trust. As he says, the trust is to let something inside, to let it play an immediate role in one's cognition and activity. When we trust, we give an external resource a direct line into one's reasoning and agents. In some sense, if we have just trust you for minimal beliefs, like the Ronaldo case, that's kind of minimal. I don't put the architecture of my mind, so to speak, at your disposal, right? But when I perspectively trust you, for example, in the Q&A, I'm allowing the metaphors you say, the perspectives that you bring in and contribute to the conversation, to shape how I'm going to go about thinking together in the future. It's kind of deeper, something deeper is going on by way of the kind of openness that I sort of exhibit when I'm thinking together with you. So on the expanded picture of thinking together isn't exhausted by belief coordination. Thinking together instead aims at a kind of perspectival coordination. This doesn't mean possessing the same information, as we just said, or believing the same content. Rather, it is a matter of sharing and being open to sharing an intuitive style of cognitively sort of engaging with the world, right? If I'm conversing with my grandfather, I can converse with him in the sense that I'm just not completely willing to see things. And he's just an old man, like he lives in the 40s. I might say that. But if I really trust him perspectively, I'm allowing him to change not just what I believe, but also how I see things more broadly, my holistic understanding in that sense. So I get back to the kind of, we can see the operation of trust, especially in the Pride and Prejudice case, right? And we can put our fingers as to why it's not actually a case of thinking together, although it might seem like it may be because they are conversing together. No. Elizabeth might entertain the perspective of Mr. Collins, but she's not thinking with him because she's not perspectively trusting him. And there's an important difference between kind of representing or just entertaining someone's perspective, right? Elizabeth can entertain Mr. Collins' perspective, but still hold it at an arm's length, right? Which she plausibly does. She understands where Mr. Collins is coming from. She understands what is salient to him. She understands the concepts that he's operating with. But she doesn't have the kind of openness. She's not letting him, for better or worse, change how she sees things. She doesn't have that kind of open, trusting attitude towards him. So I think this, so starting with this kind of notion of trust, invoking trust and its relation to thinking together, I think opens up a different model of epistemic or mental coordination. Sort of my key proposal is that in thinking together, when we're doing the Q&A, when we'll do it in like 15 minutes, what we're trying to do is we're trying to kind of align our perspectives in some sense. We're not trying to kind of share beliefs, but we're trying to coordinate on the same set of sort of attentional, inquisitive, and interpretive dispositions. To put it sort of broadly as well, so the core of thinking together, according to this view, is integrating a host of inquisitive dispositions that allows you to holistic process information the same way as I do, or as you do. It is to let you sort of structure my inquiry and my inquisitive profile, directing my own cognitive resources as to what I attend, infer, ask, and recognize as important. Not simply that I entertain your perspective, but I actually let it. I implement your perspective in my own inquiry whenever I'm doing it. I think this kind of gives us starts to give us a picture of thinking together in terms of perspectival alignment that matches some of the features that we sort of delimited earlier when we were discussing our various examples. In some sense, perspectival alignment doesn't, the core perspectival alignment doesn't appeal to a change in beliefs, right? We can, you and I can be both perspectively aligned, though we might have different beliefs in some sense, right? My grandfather, consider kind of the reverse case of my grandfather, you know, we can sort of eventually sort of believe different things about the revolution, but we can have a conversation where I can see, oh yes, the Muslim brother is actually the kind of the explanatory relevant feature of the thing, right? And I start sort of infusing my further inquiries like he does. Again, in the Q&A that we're gonna have, if you don't opinionally agree, if you don't come to kind of agree on the very same proposition at the end of our conversation, that doesn't mean that we are not successful, right? But if we have, if we, what kind of makes our instead of thinking to get successful is that kind of perspectival alignment, which doesn't seem to turn on opinional agreement. It is in some sense open-ended, right? Unlike deference, there is no clear aim or endpoint where the alignment ceases, right? At least I can't think of how the alignment might cease in a very direct way. Whereas in cases of deference, we can see, like, I just don't believe the same thing. It's harder in that sense. And because I invoked, or in a way, tried to explain thinking there in terms of perspectival trust, it shows that the trust involves, it sort of, that thinking together involves this kind of attunement that someone like Mr. Collins and Elizabeth both required in order to be thinking together. Now, as a general point, I think sort of as a, this is something I want to build on from this picture, is that perspective alignment seems to generate a different kind of epistemology, right, for its success. You know, in the deference case, the epistemic contribution of the interlocutor matters for kind of the justification of your own belief, right? But, you know, altering one, like your interlocutor perspective, is not simply a matter of kind of justification, right? It's a matter of changing what we see. It matters of selecting in the same way the evidence that we might take on whenever we're trying to form our beliefs kind of downstream. And maybe kind of this picture pulls up on the epistemic dimension once kind of slightly more developed. It pulls this picture of thinking together from cases of deference. Now, another water break. Then we'll end with the challenge. So here's kind of the background framing of what sort of slightly motivates me when I think about this picture. I think sometimes in epistemology, we're not allowed to say things because we don't have enough resources to say it. We sometimes focus on things that kind of narrows down the toolkit that we might have when we want to describe our epistemic phenomena. And I think that's a feeling that is shared among anyone sort of who done epistemology. In some sense, part of like the thinking together picture, I think outstrips three things in sort of so-called standard epistemology. On the one hand, it undermines a tendency towards what I will call propositionalism. The view that, or the idea that proposition and propositional attitudes are the target of epistemic description and evaluation, right? Holistic understanding in that sense, kind of the way that we structure information, might not be propositionally structured in that sense, right? When I look at the picture, the Gestalt picture, right? It doesn't, it's not that I know a proposition that describes that this kind of aspect of the picture is an old lady. It's just that I see it as such, right? Because some features is prominent that affects my recognitional capacities. Secondly, notice that to describe this picture of thinking together, I haven't invoked truth at all, right? Even when cases of thinking together are successful, haven't like truth doesn't play an important role, an important normative role in assessing whether this is our instinct of thinking together is successful or not. Third, I'm not sure about this quite, but I think it undermines version of evidentialism. Because notice also that I haven't invoked to describe kind of the epistemic dimension of thinking together any kind of appeal to evidence in a way. Because sometimes when we're thinking together, we're not sharing evidence. I'm not trying to, here's the evidence, and then you need to, agree with my own view. Something different is going on, right? Perspective seems to be kind of more perhaps explanatory prior to how we deal with evidence eventually. Good. So I'm going to end with this sort of idea to have like a full circle. We started with this man on an island, alive, sort of awake. He was alone. He was searching for the truth all by himself. He was the hero of the ideal of epistemic autonomy, right? He will champion like kind of think together, think alone, sorry, think for yourself, motto. So where does this picture of kind of thinking together leaves us with this sentiment, with this ideal? Think there are sort of two pictures here, right? One picture, I think, is sort of derived from the ideal of epistemic autonomy, and the other derived from the more social thinking together picture. Well, they're not incompatible, right? But both rest on different assumptions and provide different sort of regulative and action ideals, right? The thinking together picture tells us even our seemingly kind of autonomous recognition and acquaintance with the world, because we're so embedded in these activities of thinking together, these are also shaped by other people, right? And it's not that we're sort of deferring to them to tell us about some portion of part of the world that we don't know about, but they're shaping our inquisitive dispositions and perspectives quite deeply. So even at the levels of acquaintance, we seem to be intermeshed with other people. But the ideal of epistemic autonomy also recommends different remedies to our kind of hostile epistemic environments than what the thinking together picture would recommend. In a way, when we think about sort of our epistemic ailments, like our bad epistemic networks, our hostile epistemic environments that makes us bad thinkers, the ideal of epistemic autonomy recommends more thinking by yourself, more isolation, as it were. But our preferred picture, the thinking together picture, doesn't just recommend sort of a descriptive account of an everyday activity, but also, and in some important sense, recommends an ideal of living together. Thank you.